You're listening to Classic Business with Michael Avery, brought to you by Altron, there when it matters.
Welcome back to Classic Business, brought to you by Altron Technology Partners in your digital transformation journey. For more information, visit them at altron.com. Altron, there when it matters. Well, on the panel tonight, we're talking about the rise of green bonds. And obviously, climate change is widely acknowledged as one of the greatest long-term challenges facing humanity at the moment. And we've had various high-level climate negotiations taking place all over the world over the last decade. And the conference of the parties over in Paris seemed to herald an historic breakthrough where the world committed to try and keep the rise in temperatures, 195 countries unanimously agreeing to limit global temperature rises to below 2 degrees Celsius. Now, these are ambitious targets. How are we going to do this, I think, is the more important question. And the rise of green bonds is certainly an interesting component of directing capital flows into projects that will help us achieve this. To discuss the rise of green bonds tonight, we've assembled quite a formidable panel of pioneers. If we can get them on the line, it looks like my producer's having a bit of a struggle with the phone lines at the moment. Let's introduce who's in studio tonight in Joburg. Bruce Stewart, head of debt origination at Nedbank. Bruce, good to see you.
Good evening, Michael, and good evening to your listeners.
On the line in Cape Town, we've got Dr. Susan De Wit of the Bertha Centre, which is part of the Graduate School of Business at UCT. Dr. De Wit, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thank you, Michael.
And we're trying to get Gray Maguire, who's in the Department of Environmental Affairs and Development Planning in the Western Cape, and John Duncan of Old Mutual, who's head of responsible investing for you. As soon as we get them on the line, we will let you know. I think we've got Gray now. Gray, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Ah, super. Welcome. Wow, very well. Glad you could join us. And we'll leave it there at the moment as we try and get John. Bruce, kick us off. What is a green bond? What makes a bond green?
Well, essentially a green bond, certainly the first objective about a bond is to raise capital. But this is to raise capital for a very specific purpose. It's for intentional investment into a select product or range of products or projects, much as we've done with our renewable energy green bond at Nedbank, where we selected both solar and wind assets to invest in. And we went through a process of internal and external review that would then align us with the Sustainable Development Goals and qualify that particular investment as green. So when we issue the bonds to institutional investors, they know that their money specifically is directed towards those four green assets as approved, certified and verified.
As I say that, I think we've lost Dr. De Wit as well, so I'm going to throw this one over to you, Gray. And if you look at globally what's going on here, it does look like most developed countries in the global north, as we call it, have taken advantage of the green bond market and incorporated it into their existing climate investment strategies. Emerging markets, perhaps less so. If we look at what's going on in Latin America, the Caribbean, Africa, we do seem to be lagging behind. What is the global ecosystem looking like compared with the ecosystem here in South Africa for green bonds?
Yes, well, thanks for the question. It's a bit of a tricky situation for us as a developing country to really start to engage in the green bond sector, because some of the appeal that it generally has in the international context is less impactful here. So, you know, we have a relatively poor secondary market for bonds in South Africa, whereas what you do tend to find, particularly with the major issuers of green bonds internationally, which would be the USA, China, and France. I mean, between those three countries, they account for probably 70% of green bond issuances in 2018. That you would find in those countries, they have enormously strong secondary markets. And also, at the same time, they have a high-level conscientization around their environmental impacts. So the level of acceptability and demand within their economies for those kinds of products is really high. Whereas in a situation like South Africa, where we're very much a developing country with a high degree of developmental mandates that need to be oriented specifically towards social inclusion and towards being able to ensure that we're able to extend services to the majority of South Africans, it does make it harder when we find that there tends not to be any kind of premium towards green bond issuers. So if you will look, we did relatively well when it came to the City of Cape Town's green bond issuance, but it was still 3 or 4 basis points above what it was that we had been able to get from a normal standard issuance about a week prior to then out of Johannesburg's issuance. So in fact, we're not really seeing that there is the market incentive, particularly for state issuers. However, we did see that Growth Point Properties did manage to get a marginal price premium on their green bond issuance that they issued during the course of last year. It's a dynamic space, but we're definitely looking at the kind of broader contextual environment that is supporting green bond issuances overseas, and looking at how it is that we can incorporate that into the South African context, particularly as we start to look at local government borrowing much more strongly.
And Gray, you were awarded as the City of Cape Town a Green Bond Award recently that I want to come back to. Dr. De Wit, we've got you back on the line. Sorry about that. Gremlins on the phone lines at the moment. For the global context here, how big is the global green bond market? Are we still talking about quite a nascent industry globally, or has it developed quite strongly compared with where we are here, where we're only seeing a smattering of green bonds being brought to market?
So I think last year the issuance was around $170-180 billion of green bonds, and this year it's predicted to be around $250 billion worth of issuance. And if your listeners want to go out and find a little bit more about what's happening in the green bond market, there's actually a really good organization that collates information, puts it out, called Climate Bond. And it basically just gives a whole bunch of information on who, where, and how much each country has issued. Now that's a significant increase. It doesn't tell you whether projects are being financed or whether they're being refinanced. As Gray mentioned, there's a strong secondary market elsewhere, so that doesn't necessarily mean that there's new green infrastructure being developed in the market. But obviously, there is a significant push internationally because of the IPCC report, for example, that came out, biodiversity report, the urgency around the climate crisis, and we should see these kinds of instruments, the use of these instruments, rising. Now, saying that, according to a report that was released last year, actually partly supported by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, that's the large group that's looking at the consequences of this 1.5 to 2 degree increase in temperature around the world. The amount of finance that went into climate in general, and I'm not just talking about the green bond market in general, actually decreased between 2017 and 2018. And there's no necessarily a good reason for that happening. But it just shows you how much work there is to do, both in the listed space, which is obviously around the listed bonds, but also in the unlisted space around greenfield projects.
And Bruce, you nod your head there in terms of work to do in the unlisted space. It looks to me like green bonds that fund projects within the so-called Sustainable Development Goals and Green Economy make a whole lot of sense. What about those companies or projects that are looking to transition? And a lot of the issue that we're faced with currently in the world is how to have a just energy transition. How do we get old utilities that are still burning coal to start moving down into renewables and into cleaner sources? Should we not be talking here of transition bonds rather than just pure green bonds?
Absolutely, Michael. I think the previous caller made a valid point. I mean, it's all about transition. And this is the challenge we face in South Africa, from a coal-dependent energy source transitioning to a renewable energy source that's more sort of low carbon intensive. And that's the challenge that we as bankers face, is to find bankable projects that we can include or crowd in private capital to assist us in the development thereof.
That challenge to crowd projects in, Gray, I'd like you to share, or to crowd funders in, I'd like you to share your experience at a local government level. We, as you said, we've had a few at local government. I think the City of Joburg was the first one back in 2014. The City of Cape Town issued a green bond, which I think was the first to be listed on the JSE Green segment, which is 2017, around R1 billion worth. And it was a resounding success. In fact, so much so that I think the city was awarded the Green Bond of the Year award by the Climate Bonds Initiative. What has this demonstrated to you in terms of proof of concept? But more importantly, what have you learned through this process? And what would you do differently next time?
Yeah, look, I think Duncan's point was exceptionally well made about the real need is in terms of being able to develop bankable projects. So for us, our general approach from the state side of things, you have to bear in mind that we are in a very fiscally austere environment at the moment. And when we're talking about how it is that we intend to finance infrastructure at the local government level, we need to be mindful of the fact that we're talking to CFOs at local government municipalities, and I'm talking now outside of the metros, which is the majority of the municipalities in the country. We're having to talk to these CFOs, and we need to ensure that the language that we're speaking to them makes financial sense. And if we go out there and we start talking about adding on price premiums onto what it is that the infrastructure budgets are already, and to add on additional costs onto their borrowing, it's not a very attractive language. However, if we go out there and we start to talk to CFOs and to technical directors at local municipalities about total cost of ownership and being able to look at life cycle costs that go into the running the, if we were to take, for example, a wastewater treatment facility, traditionally what would happen in the past is that we would look at the least capital intensive type of technology to be able to introduce, and we'd develop our terms of reference around that. However, what we're starting to push on a much more widespread basis at the moment is introducing methodologies that allow CFOs and technical directors to incorporate broader operational expenditure requirements, which is all part of the accounting standards under GRAP 17, so that they could look at, in the case of a wastewater treatment facility, we would look at pumping and piping and the land footprint and the chemical input and the ability to be able to reuse the water post-fact and the amount of sludge production and the cost in terms of dumping of that sludge. So taking this broader perspective around costing is absolutely critical in terms of being able to develop the kinds of projects that, in our opinion, will be suitable for refinance later on under a situation where green bonds really start to deliver a price premium. So that's very much our approach.
Bruce, I want to come back to you here on the premium that green bonds would place on a project. Do they actually raise the cost of debt funding for these projects?
Michael, I think there are a couple of points here. I mean, our experience in terms of the actual funding cost was marginally below where we anticipated it to be, but that probably wasn't because it was green alone. What it did do, it just allowed much broader range of mandates to participate, or broader range of investors to participate in our auctions, and that resulted in a spread compression due to the oversubscription. So indirectly, maybe there's an argument to be made for green, and I think we've still got a long way to go because our market hasn't really, put it this way, our investor market, the mandates therein haven't really developed that strongly around green. But that's not to say that the costs in establishing a green program are prohibitive. We found, and when you're raising R1 billion bond to go and pay R200,000-300,000 to get it certified and verified, and we did use the Climate Bonds Initiative as a certification agent and Carbon Trust as a verifier in between. You know, it's when you start using auditing firms and rating agencies that the costs would escalate. And so I think we're still grappling with, in the initial stages, of finding what is universally acceptable, and prices, I think, for the verification and certification will moderate over time as this becomes more mainstream, and we sort of tend to a more common standard.
Dr. DeWitt, to that point, as the market develops in South Africa and the mandates that we see of pension funds are shifting, it was just this Rosemary Hunter helped issue that legal opinion to remind trustees of pension funds of their fiduciary responsibility, not only to current members, but to future members as well, which means they really have to take into consideration what companies and what instruments they're investing in today and what their impact will be on the future for their members. So we do seem to have a bit of a tailwind in terms of pushing institutional money into this sort of ESG and particularly green bond space.
So I think one of the ecosystem situation that's fueling this fire is talk around prescribed assets, and so there's quite a lot of conversation, collaboration, and hopefully innovation in the institutional fund space to start thinking about how to more proactively invest in the socioeconomic development of the country. So exactly what you've expressed. In other words, we're not just addressing the financial future of members, but we are improving the lives of citizens and the economy in the long run. And there are a number of initiatives that that are addressing this. You mentioned Rosemary's opinion. There's obviously the Director for Sustainable Finance that has been put out by the FSCA that has yet to be launched but has been put out into the market, that's very much associated with Regulation 28 and strengthening the reporting requirements around ESG and pension funds. But SETA has that's the industry body for pension funds, has an active working group around infrastructure in particular, where they are starting to understand the needs of their members and to see how they can start moving more money either as is into investable sort of bankable products or through blended finance structures. You have the ASISA working group, so that's the Association for Savings and Investment, that is very much looking to unlock subsectoral pipeline to attract institutional investment, say for example in student housing or in water. And so there are active collaborations that are trying to, first of all, strengthen the reporting requirements for institutional investors, but not only that, but to help to develop this bankable pipeline that pension funds require in order to be able to assure members that they are not being squanderous with their savings.
So Dr. DeWitt, it sounds almost like it certainly isn't a demand issue. There's a lot of demand out there. We just can't seem to fit that with the requisite bankable supply of green bond funded projects.
So I think the issue is on both sides, the supply and demand. And by supply, I mean the supply of capital in the market. What institutional investors will say is that they are not sufficiently de-risked projects available for them to invest in, and that do not make money available. What someone like Gray will say is that there is insufficient pipeline in the market, and money going into that pipeline development at an earlier stage in order to attract that funding. And so what we really need to see is some innovation in the market. We need to see an altered kind of a risk return calculation. We need to see blended finance products. And there are some interesting ideas out there that are being launched. So, for example, the PIC has launched a fund of funds to invest in venture capital funds. Part of their kind of sectoral focus is around green businesses. The DBSA has attracted a green climate finance facility from the World Bank to specifically go into earlier stage businesses and an associated climate lab to start testing some of these, the match between the business model and the financing model. And so really it needs to be a conversation between supply and demand side to be able to move the market. I think that's part of what we are trying to achieve with the National Task Force for Impact Investing, of which the Bertha Center is part, trying to align the supply and the demand sides of the market, not only for green, but also for other SDG-related or NDP-related issues.
As we've been speaking tonight, green, obviously environmental, but there are a whole bunch of social and also, I suppose, in the whole ESG spectrum, governance issues that could be or could make good use of this sort of funding. Bruce, I'm going to end off here with a high-level comment on whether or not we might see this potentially as a solution for Eskom, because we see sovereign wealth funds globally here looking to increase their capital to the green energy space. It does suggest that there could be lots of demand for Eskom green bonds should we wish to go that route.
To a point, I think there's certainly a space for innovative finance here. And I mean, I think the greatest contribution that a bank like Nedbank can make towards its sustainable development goal agenda is through product and advisory, as with every other financial institution. So the question is, how do you transition away from coal or make coal cleaner in the process, whilst we decrease our dependence on coal and increase our dependence on other sources of renewable energy and change that energy mix? But it's going to relate to innovative product, and whether that comes in the form of capital incentives or an impact on the variables of remuneration, or who knows?
Standardization. Gray, perhaps on the last comment, you've got 30 seconds. And to have Bruce's earlier comment about costs here and trying to strip some of those costs out, is there hope for a global green bond standard?
I wanted to, seeing as I've got 30 seconds, I just wanted to make a comment about your IRP comment. And, you know, this is one of the things that the Western Cape government has been focused very heavily on, because we were one of the leading green economy investment hubs in the world during 2015, and that was still off the back of the Renewable Energy Independent Power Producer Program. And that obviously went through a period of policy uncertainty, but now we are projecting another 200 megawatts of renewable energy in the updated IRP by 2030, and we've established the Atlantis Special Economic Zone, which is a green tech hub, and we've already secured 680 million rand worth of investment from 5 investors there, and we're looking at getting 2.7 billion by 2030, and a large part of our focus will be about the integration of the small-scale meta generation guidelines into working functionality across the province, as well as looking towards our northern neighbours as a result of the establishment of the Africa Continental Free Trade Zone. Wow. You know, our northern neighbours have got 40% electrification rates on average, so there is huge opportunity for us in order to be able to really grow the market and to work in partnership with private sector players like Nedbank and the rest of our financial institutions as well. We are having conversations with the Banking Association of South Africa around those lines.
Great. Slightly more than 30 seconds, but a lovely note to end on. Lots of opportunity, and great to hear the collaboration within the broader ecosystem. Thank you very much, Dr. Susan De Wit, too, and Bruce Stewart, Head of Debt Capital Market Debt Origination at Nedbank. That's a wrap from the Classic Business team tonight. Sylvia A. in the Jazz Lounge in Cape Town, and in Gauteng, Carolyn Stain up next with Winding Down. Thanks for tuning in to the Classic Business Show, which was brought to you as always by Altron, technology partners in your digital transformation journey.